After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nichtern, creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/David.
Hello, everybody. I'm David Nichtern, and welcome to another edition of my podcast, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. Today's guest is my friend Daniel Aitken, who happens to be my publisher of my books, and also is a serious Dharma brother and companion along the meditation path, a student of Garwang Rinpoche, serious student. So we're going to talk to Daniel a little bit about some of his aspects of his life and bringing together these different elements of his life. First, Daniel, maybe could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Mm-hmm. So I'm publisher of Wisdom Publications. And I have a PhD in Buddhist studies. Focusing on the Tibetan language mainly. And I've had senior executive roles in a number of multinationals, mainly to do with marketing and branding. And that led those twin sort of parallel interests in my life of business and Dharma sort of have come together and joined in my most, you know, in this incarnation of my career as at Wisdom Publications. So.
Considering the book that we just put out together, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, now that I'm thinking about it, it's just hugely auspicious that we ended up working on that book and putting it out through your company, because you are a manifestor of those principles, clearly.
Yeah, you speak a lot about tendril.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is a form of tendril for myself, that this manuscript came across my desk, and it's the type of Dharma meets practical life that I love. You know, the testing ground for this wisdom, you know, business is a great workshop to test these practices in. So yeah, I love your book for that reason.
Can you explain what tendril is for folks who might not know?
Tendril, you often talk about tendril as like an auspicious connection, right? There's different terms in Tibetan, trinle or tendril, tendril gichungwa. And it means dependent origination. But in this sort of context, it means the coming together of different conditions. And you use the word synchronicity. And I think that gets to it, that word synchronicity.
Well, so of course, it's interesting to consider What role did that play, for example, in you meeting your teachers? You have some very, very potent and, you know, kind of highly regarded Tibetan teachers. And you must have met them somewhere along the way. How did that happen?
You know, I was very interested in Dharma from a young age. And
how young?
Very young. So I was definitely, you know, reading Dharma books when I was like 10, 11. No, actually, sorry, probably 13, more like 13. Seriously, just reading and searching. And then after a while, you know, went looking for Dharma centers and used to drop into different Dharma centers.
At 13 in Australia?
No, a little bit later. So like I'd be reading, 13 I was at high school, so reading at high school. And then later, you know, as I got into college, I, you know, got out into the world a little bit more and looked, you know, dropped into Dharma centers.
So what year are we talking about? When were you in college?
I was in college, 90s, early 90s.
Early 90s. Yeah. And were there Dharma centers in Australia at that point?
I didn't, the first one I was reading, I didn't think there were. But it turned out that there was, you know, there's great interest in Dharma in Australia and there was many centers.
Tibetan particularly?
Yeah, Tibetan Buddhist centers, but in Sydney. And I was a little bit of, where I grew up was about an hour out of Sydney. So then I, but then, you know, and then sometimes visiting teachers would come through. So then I'd drop into different centers. But eventually I found my way to this center in Sydney and saw and met a teacher there that really struck an accord with me.
Just met him at a talk or something?
Yeah, he, you know, I'd go into Dharma talks and then I'd ask the teacher a question or two. And normally be unsatisfied with the answer.
Were you kind of a smart aleck kid or did, you know?
I don't think so. I don't know.
But did you feel respectful to them?
Yeah, or, So I, you know, very respectful and just sort of ask questions at the end. And but then this teacher, I sort of asked some questions and was blown away by the answers. And so then I kept asking questions.
Yeah.
And then I was like, it seemed like this lama knew everything.
And who was that?
That was Geshe Ngawang something.
Who's one of your main teachers?
One of my main teachers, yeah.
And do you remember any question you asked him and what answer he gave you?
I can't remember exactly. I just remember the feeling.
Okay.
The feeling of, oh my gosh.
Right.
And then that the answers were so exact and precise.
Wow.
So that really captured me. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to hang around a little bit.
So you still work with that teacher, right?
Yes.
And he's obviously older than you, right?
Or, yeah.
A lot older? Or?
No. So 15 years.
Oh, so he's still going to be around for a while.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And your other teacher is?
Gawan Rinpoche, who you know. Sermon Gawan Rinpoche. So I met Rinpoche. Well, my first encounter with Rinpoche was in Sikkim at his monastery.
Right.
But it wasn't.
What were you doing there? Did you just happen
to? I was actually with Geshe La. We were doing pilgrimage. And we went up to Sikkim and then we went to this monastery and Rinpoche's monastery in Sikkim there in Lingdom Gompa. And I went into the Gompa there and it just blew me away. There was a statue of Padmasambhava and 16 Kamapa, huge statues, and then the Buddha. And then I was really intrigued by that lineage. Turns out that Rinpoche, I was going to America soon after. And Rinpoche was going to America soon after as well. So then we...
You went together?
No, no. We didn't really even know each other. That was like the first encounter. But then I met Rinpoche in Boston there. So that's how I came in contact with Rinpoche there.
In Boston, you met?
In Boston.
But you had seen him in Sikkim? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you met him in Boston?
Yeah, we connected in Boston.
Do you remember the first conversation you had?
You know, I didn't even, I remember seeing Rinpoche for the first time in Boston. So it was in, it was at Harvard and Rinpoche was undercover in a Buddhist 101 class. Can you imagine?
Teaching it, you mean?
No, as a student in the background. No, and he didn't have robes on. He was really undercover.
Wow.
And then I... And
but you recognized him.
I didn't recognize him. I recognized him as, I don't know, there was this weird thing. I walked in and then I felt, I saw Rinpoche up in the back and I bowed. But I didn't know who it was. But I just felt like, and he was like, and then he was like, well, who is this person who sort of knew me?
Busting
and Ali
my
was
cover.
The same. Yeah, Ali was the same. And so then
Ali being your wife.
Yeah, Ali, yeah, Ali, my wife. So we both had that same karmic feeling. And so then the rest, then there was just that connection. So we didn't know. And then Rinpoche came. Actually, Rinpoche, the next class, Rinpoche had printed something out from the last class on the same topic as the last class. And he gave it to us. And he said, this is that. So he's, and it turned out that we didn't even know who he was still. Right.
Kidding.
And but it was a printout from his own book.
And do you remember what that printout
it was about the stages of death in the Bardo.
So a nice introductory topic and mindfulness in everyday life, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, a lot of people these days, Daniel, ask when you go out and teach workshops, how do I find a teacher? Mm. How would you answer them?
Don't know. I think it's very karmic. Uh-huh. I feel like with Geshe-la and with Rinpoche for me, and both Rinpoche and Geshe-la have said, like one time Geshe-la, when he was explaining karma, he said to me, so why am I here? And why are you here? Mm. And why have our paths crossed in Sydney here? What are the odds? And that was his way of teaching me karma, because I used to be very skeptical of karma. And then Rinpoche has said the same things. He's like, you know, only these sort of like strange conditions, he considers that karma has sort of brought us together.
Right.
So I think with teacher and student, it's very karmic.
Mm-hmm. So should somebody look?
Yeah.
They absolutely should look. You were looking.
Yeah, definitely.
And you were asking questions, which is an interesting piece of the puzzle. I'm curious, we're going to get to your professional life in a little bit, but the Dharma piece is so intriguing in a way. People are aware of the origins of some of these teachings coming from, you know, Tibet and Japan and China and so forth. And I think there was an influx of teachings starting in, you know, the late 60s and early 70s. Into the West, and now it's pretty full on. And I think a lot of people are getting access to Buddhism without even knowing where it came from, really, or what the basic sort of tenets of, you know, the original formations of it were. You got a PhD in Buddhist studies.
Yes.
So did you contemplate becoming a monastic at some point?
Early on, when I was spending a lot of time with Geshe-la, it sort of come up.
He was a monastic, right?
Yeah, he's a monastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'd spent a lot of time with him. And with his other Geshe friends.
Uh-huh.
And so it felt like I was always around monks. And then it would be more easier if I was a monk to go to the monasteries with Geshe-la in India.
Would have been just, easier.
It would have been easier, especially for Geshe-la, I think, mm-hmm. rather than having a lay person be in all these situations. But yeah, so I felt a little bit like it might be more convenient.
Uh-huh. Oh. Uh-huh.
But I never felt. You know, I had these conversations with Geshe-la, and I'd say mm-hmm. to Geshe-la, well, Geshe-la's, especially Geshe-la's friends, who would say, well, would you come, like, talk about being a monk?
Yeah.
And I said, well, if you can convince me that I should become a monk,
yeah,
because they're logicians, these Geshe's,
yeah,
and they sort of, you know, we discussed, but then I said, there's many lay practitioners in Tibetan history,
yeah,
and they did okay. So maybe this will be okay.
Keeping with the sort of topic, this general topic of creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. So your spiritual track was very deeply laid early on, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Really a profound part of who you are and what mm-hmm. you're interested in this lifetime. So how did your professional life develop? Why didn't you just say, you know, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to make my life. I have a PhD. I'm going to translate texts. I'm going to be a hardcore professional Buddhist.
Yeah.
What
I
happened?
Think the business thing had taken off before the PhD thing.
So I
did my first degree in business.
Oh.
And so I was always interested in branding and marketing. And so I was always juggling these two sort of, you know, the Dharma and marketing and branding.
Yeah.
So there's sort of, it felt like two lives for a while there.
So this is, we have this in common, right? Yes. The feeling of going back and forth between the two worlds.
Yeah.
Did it ever feel like you're being pulled apart? Like, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, like, wow, this is so... so intense. I, you know, tell a story in my book how I had to leave Los Angeles, you know, at the sort of peak in the 70s of my music career, and then going off to be the head of Karmachilling, you know, Contemplative Center for 2 years, that there was some feeling of like being pulled apart in two different directions. Did you have that same experience or that same feeling?
I think your story was more like, you know, you really made a choice to go in one direction for a little while.
Right.
And gave up a huge opportunity in career.
Yeah.
I always tried to have my cake and eat it too. But it did feel like to excel in any one, you needed to make a choice.
Wow.
And so was I compromising?
Right.
And for me, it was always going to be, the choice was always going to be Dharma rather than business. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, I always felt that you needed to be able to support yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, you
right
have
livelihood.
Right livelihood. Mm-hmm. It's not set up like in India or Tibet, our culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no support system for a professional Dharma student.
Yeah, being a monk is right livelihood yeah. in those cultures.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's seen that way.
Exactly. So I didn't mm-hmm. even feel like there was that option for a professional Dharma student.
Well, couldn't you have been the, you know, next generation Robert Thurman, you know, professor at a prestigious university of Buddhist studies, translator of texts,
you know,
teacher?
Yeah, I never had that wish. Uh-huh. So the reason I did my PhD is one of my other teachers was dying, and his last sort of like instruction to me was go get a PhD. And I resisted. I said, no, I don't want to do that. Wow. And then he basically commanded me.
Wow.
So I ended up agreeing and wow. said, okay.
And I'll where go, did you get that PhD?
University of Tasmania. Yeah. He sort of suggested that as well. So
wow. Where's Tasmania?
Yeah, yeah. In the bottom of nowhere. No, bottom of Australia. You know Australia?
Sure.
The yeah. island down at the bottom there, that's right. Tasmania.
It's pretty easy to say that you've put these two things together into your current job, which is as you're the CEO and the publisher of Wisdom, right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little about what Wisdom's mission is.
Wisdom's mission is to connect people with the authentic Buddhist tradition.
Okay.
So for people who
specifically
want to,
Buddhist.
Yeah, yeah. Buddhist.
Okay.
So connect people with authentic Buddhist wisdom. That's sort of the mission. And the way I describe it is, you know, the mission sort of expands as time goes on in mm-hmm. terms of how we connect people.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're trying to connect them with is pretty consistent, these timeless truths of Buddhism.
Well, I'm now doubly honored to be on that imprint because, you know, some people could argue my book is sort of not so timeless.
No, I think
more timely.
No, yeah. It's timely, yeah. And but the principles in it.
Yeah.
Are timeless,
yeah,
in a way.
Well, it's interesting that you see it as a Buddhist book, I guess.
Absolutely,
yeah. It's interesting. I'm trying to personally bring it out in a way that it's not constricted by that identification.
Yeah,
you know that the type of meditations that's presented in our universal mindfulness and compassion, things like that. So you wouldn't take a Hindu book or a Sufi book or a shaman book and publish it on Wisdom.
Most likely not. It would have to have some connection.
Right.
So it would have to have some Buddhist connection tradition. To Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, you remember my suggestion for the book that we could put together for Wisdom that would sell millions of copies.
What is that one again?
Wisdom for Dummies.
Wisdom for Dummies. Yeah, we got to do that book. I think I can write that book. I'll definitely need to read it.
Or it could just be WISDUMB.
Yeah, yeah, Wisdom.
Wisdom. So
there's a creativity coming out.
Yeah, there you have it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about, as you know, the kind of sense of vision, which you're clearly a visionary in terms of taking that job on. And then what is your notion of the vision for Wisdom going forward? Yeah. I mean, obviously one thread of it is to be authentic portal for
yeah.
traditional Buddhist wisdom. But what else could you add to that mix that would be unique to your vision for it?
Yeah, there was a conference I was at, and I was asked to speak about the future of publishing mm-hmm. in the Buddhist context.
Mm-hmm.
So, and basically it was a gathering of all people who run Dharma centers.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few of people. It was like an international gathering.
Mm.
And so I started off by saying, who in the room first encountered Buddhism via a book? And 99% of the people put up their hands.
Yeah, sure.
And then it's right. like, it just shows how important books have been in the transmission of these teachings to the West.
Yeah.
And then, but then I said, and most of them were, you know, baby boomers, Gen X,
mm-hmm.
you know, people, directors of centers. And I said, imagine 10 years from now, imagine 15 years from now. And I asked the same question. Mm-hmm. There's going to be less hands raised. And wow. so how are people connecting with the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
whether it's YouTube, whether it's Facebook, who knows where yeah. that's going? And I said, that's the future.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be in those places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wisdom has to be in those places. And so I felt a big part of the vision that I needed to bring to Wisdom was to help Wisdom be in those places.
Yeah.
So get into different media,
yeah.
do podcasts. do online courses, the stuff we've been doing together.
You know, as you're saying that, Daniel, I'm thinking that scene from The Matrix where Neo has to learn Kung Fu.
Yes.
And they plug him in and they show him doing it. And then like seconds later, he looks up and goes, I know Kung Fu.
Exactly.
It's like, I'm a Kenpo,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Like plugging in and somebody has 15 years of Buddhist training implanted into them.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling almost to think how, and it's interesting to think about, as the media changes from books to whatever, you know, multimedia, digital communication, how the training goes, you know, does that change the way that people will be trained in the future, do you think?
Absolutely. I think books will be always important as far as I can see for now.
Uh-huh.
But it's the auxiliary content.
Uh-huh.
So like we have your book now,
right?
But we just have been filming together a lecture series,
right?
And so most likely people will come across the lecture series before they read the book,
right? So that's the 99% of the hands that went up.
Absolutely,
15% of the hands are going to go by saw it online or saw
the lecture series. And then maybe 99%
first
encountered Dharma online.
Well, do you think books have a future as books?
Absolutely. Yeah.
50 years from now, do you think somebody will be sitting reading a book on a beach?
People will be reading.
But
and we can call it a book. What it will look like, who knows?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I think there's a place for you know, written content.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah. Of course, the Buddhist path trajectory started before books started. Isn't that true? Can you say a little bit about that for people who don't know?
I think the oral transmission has always been important for Buddhism.
But there were no books.
Yeah.
At the very, like from the time that Buddha lived and taught,
as
I understand it, for about several hundred years, there was no written transmission.
That's right.
So it was only oral transmission.
Yes. Memorization becomes very important in that.
But it's still a game of telephone, you know?
Yeah.
Four noble truths. I thought there were five. What's the fifth noble truth? So, the oral transmission. Now, what are the different kinds of transmissions in Buddhism? There are more than one, right?
Yes. So there's the, what do you mean exactly?
Well, like, there's oral, there's mind transmission, right?
Oh,
there's
okay.
Sign transmission.
Yeah, so there is the, what is it, the four kindnesses of a lama.
Okay,
and it's they do the transmission by oral, by sign, by mind, and I think written is, I don't know if written is one of them. There might be three.
Uh-huh.
It's escaping me at the moment, but I know what you're talking about.
Oral, at least oral.
Yeah.
Gesture or mudra.
Just sign, yeah.
And direct transmission, mind to mind.
This is in the Dzogchen teachings. They talk about this a lot.
Yeah. So that's true, not just of Buddhism, but kind of everything, right? In a way.
Yes.
You know, if you think about
body, speech, and mind,
it's body, speech, and mind, it's how we communicate. Those three,
yeah.
So, do you think Buddhism suffers from being perceived as a kind of specialized kind of knowledge, maybe not accessible because it seems clouded in kind of intricacy? You just said something like really powerful.
Mm.
Body, speech, and mind is how we communicate.
Yeah.
Now, if you then say, oh, well, it's Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya, and you start to articulate the 19 versions of this and that, can you lose the power of something as powerful and simple as saying, we communicate through body, speech, and mind?
Things get lost in the details for sure.
Yeah.
And there is a tradition of the pith instruction.
Yeah. What's that?
And that is direct statements that get you straight to the heart.
Yeah.
Of and this is like, you know, and signs can do that, right? Signs.
Like E equals MC squared?
Yeah. We could say that.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, this is pith instructions. This is the real essence. And, you know, when you've got someone who has really tasted it and is giving you instructions from experience,
it's
very powerful.
So can you cite a couple of examples of pith instructions?
I think the Dohas from Sadaha. You know, there's a thing called Gur in like a spiritual songs, dohas.
Sure.
And what that is, what a doha is when a great master has realization, they express it through body, speech, and mind.
Right.
And it's spontaneous. So expression through body might be dance. So we have, and this is creativity at play,
okay,
right? So a great master has a realization and then spontaneously expresses it through dance, through song, and of course their mind, it's an expression of their mind.
Well, and those traditional monastic dances that people see, somebody made those up at a certain point.
Yeah, right? That's where it came from. So like the famous, we share a tradition, mm-hmm. the Zhongmang tradition, mm-hmm. and the Zhongmang tradition is very famous for a Chakrasambhara dance. Mm-hmm. And this chakra, the origins of this Chakrasambhara dance is from a yogi that got, who is realized and then expressed that realization through their body. Mm-hmm. And then that gets passed down and then becomes more formalized. And this is where the details come in.
Sure.
So the dance we see now, and in Tibet, they will do that dance 24 hours. Like it won't stop. So they'll have different teams come in.
Oh.
And it's all formalized and ritualized. But maybe that looks quite different to the original essence of what that dance was. I don't know, but we can say that.
But in terms of creativity,
yeah,
and people saying, well, you're not really creating anything. This is traditional. You know, people like to say that Dharma is traditional. I'm doing it the way it was done. Somebody in the beginning made the whole thing up.
Oh, expression is creativity.
Right. So all these forms which sort of feel like you have to do it this way and hold it this way and so forth, somebody in the beginning just said, I think I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah, and if you think about where those dances came from, they were creative expressions of realization.
Okay.
You cannot get more. It's the essence of spontaneous action.
Right. So it's a funny twist, isn't it? That spontaneity, and we've joked about this before. Yeah. But when you look at these very formalized monastic institutions, you know, and their 15-year Kenpo degrees and stuff.
Yeah.
It all goes back to, in our tradition, to Crazy Yogi Talopa.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? And, who my son Ethan would say, by today's standards, would be analyzed as having a psychotic break. Seeing blue people in the sky and, you know. So what do you think the balance is, because we can take this into the creative world, between the spontaneous quality of realization and then this ritualized follow-up on it? How do you maintain that balance?
I think it's one is outwardly. Mm-hmm. So when someone has realization and they express it, it's very spontaneous. But then you can use, if you don't have the realization, you can use that expression and mimic that expression to get back to the realization.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a ladder?
Like a ladder. So that's how it gets formalized. And then you get taught a dance, or you get taught a visualization or a song, and you use that to connect with that original source from where that creative energy came from, which is the realization.
But can you get hung up on the ladder?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So then the forms sort of take over for a period of time.
For sure.
And then that's somebody breaks through. You know, maybe you can tell people about the mad yogi of Bhutan.
Oh, Drupka Kunli.
Yeah.
Drupka Kunli, yeah.
Yeah, because I think this idea of crazy wisdom is something, some people are magnetized by it, some people are repelled by it. They just say, oh, this is fake thing, and, you know, these are just crazy people. Mm. But the way Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about it was, he said, the right translation is wisdom crazy.
Yeah.
So the wisdom comes first, meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the crazy is not crazy, it's just from a conventional point of view. It's beyond sort of conventional forms.
Yeah.
So Drukpa Kunli was, what, 15th century AD in Bhutan?
Yeah, I think something like that, yes.
And he did all kinds of strange things to wake people up, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. He was out there, that's for sure.
So what's the balance between that kind of bursting somebody's bubble, let's say the part of the Dharma teachings where you're breaking through somebody's conventional mind, and also sort of training them to be kind of more linear and more logical? You have the unusual quality of studying the Gelugpa tradition, which is maybe perhaps a little more linear or not necessarily.
For sure I see Geshe-la as like the great scholar side of things,
right,
and Rinpoche as the Siddha.
Yeah.
Definitely. Although Rinpoche is a Kenpo as well and has been trained very well. And of course Geshe-la is a yogi.
Right.
But you know, they have different emphasis.
What's their relationship like?
They don't really know each other, only through me asking. Well, Rinpoche said this or Geshe-la said that.
Like your father.
Putting them into imaginary debate.
Like your father and mother.
yeah, exactly.
So that's, you know, I mean, here's a conversation you and I have had at Hungawi restaurant, which is a great vegan Korean restaurant in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this book coming out, and I said, well, how many copies of the book do you think we're going to sell? Mm-hmm. And I think you said something like 8,000. I said 800,000.
Yeah.
You know, which was sort of the vision of the project. And then I said to you, I asked you, what's your vision for your personal future?
Mm.
And it was interesting. At the same time, like it was like watching somebody with binoculars, and they split, and one went left and one went right.
Yeah.
You said, I would like to, with Ali, your wife, yeah, I'd like to do a 10-year retreat. That was one train of thought.
Yeah.
And then the other, really quite simultaneously, without any kind of like cognitive dissonance or gap, you said, on the other hand, I would like to take wisdom into the future and create a very broad platform for the sort of onset of and availability of the Buddhist wisdom into the West. And I just looked at you for a while, you know, and I thought, you're a perfect person. You should read my book.
I did your workbook, which was fantastic.
Well, how would you resolve those? I want to say I resonated deeply with both of those aspirations, but how would you resolve them in a sort of linear time, in a temporal domain, which we live?
Yeah, it's been the story of my life in a way, trying to solve that puzzle.
Okay.
And I've been through various iterations of when I was doing marketing, I've always brought Buddhism into it. So I was like, okay, marketing, basically that's just Dakshin Namje. Mm-hmm. Just equalizing yourself with others. So if you get very good at being able to look from someone else's perspective in the Lojong practice, then you can just do that in marketing. So who's my audience? What's their need? And so you jump into their shoes, and then you can come up with a proposition, and your whole marketing campaign takes away from that.
So who is your audience?
If my audience or was...
Wisdom.
Oh, wisdom's audience?
Yeah.
I think people who want to live... inspired and meaningful lives, and have a tendency to draw that inspiration from Dharma.
From Buddhist Dharma.
From Buddhist Dharma.
Yeah. So one, A is to live an inspired and meaningful life.
Yeah.
And two is we're providing a channel for those people, in particular the ones who see an important element of that is studying the traditional Buddhist teachings.
Yes.
That's pretty good. Do you have that as your vision statement for the company now?
That's my personal vision statement for the company. So when I was doing your workbook, that's sort of the thing stuff
that's
I was
the
writing
of thing
down.
That you wrote down.
And it's very much in accord with my own values of what I'm trying to do
in your life.
In my life, yeah.
Is there a sense of the size of that market? You're a branding and marketing guy, you said.
Yeah.
So what's the size of that market? I want to be inspired and visionary in my life, and I want to sort of access the Buddhist teachings as an important channel for that.
Yeah, to me, that's millions of people.
You know how many Jewish people there are on the planet Earth?
No, tell me.
Take a guess. We're very
20 million.
It's only 14 million.
14 million.
So and there's like, I think, how many Buddhists? I think maybe 200 million Buddhists.
Yeah, it depends if you count the Chinese.
Yeah,
Buddhists.
Yeah.
If you count them, it's like huge.
Yeah, and then there's something like 800 million Hindus and like a couple of billion Christians, and Muslim also is a big one. So the Buddhist crowd, even just if you use that metric, there's already a lot of people to talk to.
That's right.
My premise is that many, many people say, I'm kind of a Buddhist, but I'm not a registered Democrat. I'm kind of a Democrat, I'm not a registered Buddhist.
Yeah. So that's why I say people who draw inspiration from the Buddhist world, you don't have to be Buddhist.
Well, so look at the mindfulness revolution. Yeah. Is that a Buddhist revolution, do you think?
No, I think mindfulness goes beyond Buddhism. For example, the Buddha himself learnt meditation from the yogis, forest yogis that were around at his time. So Buddhism can't lay claim to ownership of the practice of mindfulness. I don't believe. Yeah.
So the focusing or concentration element, the shamatha element, is not inherently Buddhist, is what you're saying?
No, the Buddhist teachers were going into jhanas. There's some people that say that the term, they weren't really going to jhana.
Yeah.
But anyway,
say what jhana is for the people who don't know.
Just deep absorption of meditative absorption, deep meditative absorption.
And like a kind of going into a zone, kind of a certain kind of spaced out quality.
I don't know if it's spaced out, but it's withdrawal.
Withdrawal.
And it's withdrawal, and it's a deep absorption, meditative absorption.
Right.
And to where you withdraw from this form.
Okay, now don't a lot of people think that's what meditation is for? When you talk to people,
they think checking out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's, as a meditation teacher, that's probably the single most consistent thing I try to communicate is we're not checking out, we're checking in.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you say Buddhism then, like, how would you define, in other words, you're sort of limiting, in a way, your vision to the people who are paying attention to the Buddhist tradition. Can you visualize a segment of the population that might not characterize themselves that way, but that might be interested in the basic principles that we're talking about?
Absolutely. I think the content drives our audience, right?
Uh-huh.
So the people interested in the type of content we're drawing from. You don't have to say, I'm Buddhist, uh-huh. but to benefit from your book, anyone who mm-hmm. might be inspired by some of the ideas in your book,
right.
that's our audience.
Right.
But I don't think you can also say, we're going to be everything to everyone. Obviously, you don't want to do that.
Yeah. It sounds like you have a clear mission and a clear focus. Probably potentially more so, like you have two things, but a lot of people at your stage might have 30 things or no things. It seems clear those are your two.
Which two?
The branding and marketing and bringing the Buddhist wisdom to the world. To the niche and to the larger group, and your own personal evolution as a practitioner.
Yeah, and I'm coming, I'm coming to new understandings around that, because I used to think that you had to do the personal work first before you could bring something to the world,
mm-hmm.
and then.
Then you'd be dead.
Then you'd be dead. I also like the analogy. I think Freud had this. No. Jung maybe had the analogy of the alchemist, right?
Uh-huh.
And so the alchemist is there trying to turn lead or some substance into gold, right?
Right.
He's into the transforming the
mm-hmm.
substance.
Mm-hmm.
But the real work he's doing is, as he's doing that, is transforming himself,
mm.
right? Mm-hmm. So now I think of my work at Wisdom. It's not like my work at Wisdom is also my work on myself. So they're coming together in that way that, the analogy of the alchemist. I quite like that.
But you've sort of mixed these two elements in your day, right? You spend a fair amount of time doing your personal practice,
mm-hmm.
and then you work your butt off to run the company.
That's right.
So do you find you have any time or life left at all over after that, or is that pretty much a consuming formula?
It's fairly consuming,
yeah.
I'd say, I think.
Do you have any hobbies?
Surfing, but I don't do much surfing in Boston.
No. Yeah. So.
But I'm always, for
me. Are you still surfing actively when you travel?
When I go back to Australia, I'll go surfing. And
wow.
Yeah.
You still have, where's your board?
My board's in Australia. Yeah.
At folks' house?
At my brother's house.
Your brother's house? And is he still surfing?
Yeah. Most of my brothers still surfing.
What do they think of your Buddhism thing?
That's just who I've always been. Sometimes they say, don't zen out on me. That's their line.
Zen out
don't
on
zen out
which
on me.
Which means like stay in the fray, stay with us.
It's
have
like,
a beer, put a shrimp on the barbie.
Sort of that, sort of that.
What do you think is uniquely Australian about you? What does it mean to be Australian? What's the gestalt of an Australian person?
I think Australian has a she'll be right type attitude. That's like a relaxed attitude to drama. She'll be right, mate, is what we say. It's sort of like a...
It'll be all right.
It'll be all right. Like,
so it's sort of like almost Jamaican or something.
Yeah.
It's an island kind of culture.
Yeah, Australia's an island. So there's this sort of... I think of Australia, now I have a different perspective of Australia. I see Australia, but although it's changing a lot and fast, Australia's there's a real leisure culture about it, especially where I grew up.
Okay.
There's a very God realm sort of.
So it's not like work yourself to death kind of thing like America is or Japan.
Yeah, it's not like, so of course, if you work in Sydney down in Martin Place, where I used to work.
Right.
There is that. But the general feel, everyone's
chill.
Chill. Yeah. And, what's your next holiday?
Right.
How was your last holiday?
Right.
There's a lot of that. And now Australians are going to beat me up when I go back for saying that. But that's the feeling I get.
Maybe they won't. Maybe that's part of the thing that they like.
I think it's a fantastic part of the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as a Buddhist practitioner, where does chill fit in? What instruction have you ever received in your Buddhist studies that would equate to chill?
Yeah. The yoga of chilling out. I like that yoga the best.
And what is that? Is that Mahamudra?
Rinpoche is the better, that's one of his instructions, is Rangsha Shak. just relax, relax. A lot of his meditation instructions is to relax, relax.
So that's sort of Mahamudra style,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know what that is, it's kind of a sort of very developed, advanced style of meditation, but it's very simple at the same time,
yeah.
Would you say?
The instruction's very simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the words are very simple, but... Yeah.
So he's telling you, okay, well, I'm going to give you this very ornate, elaborate practice to do, but just relax while you're doing it. Don't.
Yeah, yeah, so...
Or don't even do the elaborate practice, which?
So it depends on the person, but for me, Rinpoche's... there's a lot of elaboration, but the essential point of the meditation practice is to rest and relax. Like Tulopa's famous, like Rinpoche is considered Tulopa, so he's famous. Rinpoche's the instruction, me know me, sam me, sem me, chö me, gom rang sashak. It's like, don't reflect, don't project, don't fixate, just relax.
Yeah. Well, you just said a powerful thing. Garwang Rinpoche, your teacher, and who lives in Sikkim most of the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is considered to be an emanation, as we say sometimes in the Tibetan tradition, of the founder of the entire Kagyu lineage, which is Tulopa, who we mentioned earlier as a crazy yogi, who, by the way, was a hippie by anybody's standards, lived by the banks of a river, was eating just the fish heads that the fishermen were throwing away. And when his key disciple, Naropa, who was like the Bob Thurman of the ancestral story, the professor, the PhD at Nalanda University, goes to find his teacher, and they say, that's him over there, and he literally can't believe that that's going to be the guy who's going to teach him.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing. So, and you're saying that Garwang Rinpoche is, in essence, the same type of mind, the same type of energy.
He's considered the emanation of Tulopa, yeah. And has a close relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche. That's our brotherly Dharma bond as well. So our two teachers are...
That's some deep stuff there. Yeah. So for those of you who are not into this lore, I mean, the basic point that we're making is that the quality of the realized, practitioners in the Buddhist, they can be extremely spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not this programmed, highly intellectualized, calibrated thing. It's like you don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Tulopa was famous for upsetting Naropa's expectations of what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
You know, so do you have that relationship with your Tulopa? Does he throw you off the top of buildings and make you
go? Rinpoche doesn't throw me off the top of buildings, no. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the student, right? I couldn't handle it.
Is there a way he pulls the rug out from
you? I think that's a good teacher will do that from time to time.
Yeah.
And Rinpoche definitely plays the complete role for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is an interesting thing for people who are just starting to pick up these threads in the West and explore what these kind of teachings are. I think it's helpful to emphasize that there are many levels of teachers that you can encounter.
Yeah.
And you're talking about somebody who, you know, you have a very deep, full commitment to. But aren't there also teachers who, can just point, give you instructions about how to meditate and how to do compassion practices and stuff? Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think there's many different types of teachers. And depending on the type of instructions you want, different, like learning anything, like learning the piano, right? And you don't necessarily need to learn from like a...
Vladimir Horowitz.
Yeah, exactly. So
okay, play your C scale.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Yeah.
So I think there's the same in Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I think that you have to know what register you're in as well, because it's important in terms of the way you relate to that teacher. And
sure.
So you don't, you know.
And it's mutual too, isn't it?
The
teacher and the student are having a mutual creation. I think people don't understand that either completely.
Yeah. I agree.
You know, it's like, oh, it's the teacher's creation, but it's a mutual creation.
Yeah.
So it's very unusual though that he's from a classical Buddhist tradition and giving you, treating you not like a kind of second class student, but really empowering you with the full transmissions and teachings that he has. It's unusual.
I think Rinpoche is very, very generous, very kind.
And what kind of business person is he?
His father was an amazing businessman.
Really?
In Sikkim, he was, so Rinpoche's grandfather was the king of Sikkim. right?
Well, there
and
you
so
go.
His mother was,
ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, his mother was a prince. It's often in Buddhism, like the you know Buddha was a prince as well.
So sure.
There's this theme that runs through, and I'm not really sure what that is. But and in any yeah. case, Rinpoche's father was a great businessman in Sikkim, yeah. and he's growing up. He Rinpoche was either going to be a great businessman,
yeah, or just or, like Buddha,
or yeah. So that's what they say about him. His family says, "Wow, if he had gone into business,
yeah,
it would have been fantastic."
Well, and as it is, doesn't he advise people on all kinds of levels of activity, not just Dharma? Like, if would somebody come and say, "Should I buy this shopping mall?"
Yeah, people do Rinpoche. That. Yeah, so Rinpoche does predictions and stuff like
he
that.
He does.
Yeah,
and he'll, or he'll
did
give
Trungpa
them,
Rinpoche do that? Did people
well,
come and ask him that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think that in the traditional role of the Lama, and it's hard, there's no real comparable thing in the West, but you know, in China and Japan and Tibet, the person's your physician, they're your shrink, they're your, maybe your calligraphy teacher, you know, and your friend and advisor. So I think anybody raised in that tradition, as Trungpa Rinpoche was, is used to people going, oh, I have this new girlfriend, and what should I do? Should I marry her? And, you know, he had two ways of interacting, three really. One was definitely do that.
Yeah.
Two was your guess is as good as mine, which is the other extreme. And three was somewhere like looking at the subtleties of what's going on and maybe exploring it with you, like helping you solve your life puzzle.
I think I've seen Rinpoche do all three as well.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes they go, whoop.
Yeah.
What's that great saying? Not my circus, not my clowns.
Not my circus, not my clowns. I love it.
I love that. It solves a lot of problems when you just know when to say that.
So maybe when I hear Rinpoche say it's not definite.
Right.
It's not definite when he means not my circus, not my clowns.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, for us as students and as teachers, sometimes it's helpful. I have, as you know, a Chinese teacher in New York, Sat Han. Master Han, I remember one time I was, because you know me, I like to get inside people's little life puzzle and nudge around with them. And I was talking about somebody that way, and Sat Han said to me, eat your own noodles.
Eat your own noodles. Wow. I love that saying.
So that's another good one. Not my circus, not my concert. Eat your own noodles.
You see, these, I think, like, if you run your business like this or your creative project, it's gonna help tremendously. So all these advices, all these Dharma advices, I think they apply so much. Like, you know, I always think of like the three trainings, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
These can be applied.
Can you explain what that is?
Also, Shila is like discipline.
Right.
Samadhi is like concentration and attention. Right. And Prajna is wisdom.
Okay.
Intelligence. And so we can talk about Shila. Shila, right? Which is discipline.
And this is Sanskrit, everybody.
Yeah, Sanskrit, yeah. So I feel like, you know, basically the essence of it is don't do stupid stuff. Right?
That's the wisdom essence.
Don't do stupid stuff. Yeah. What does that mean? Well, you know, no killing, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct, no intoxicants. You, of course, you know, so in business, what can we grab? So if you're running your business, I think the no lying, the right speech, and no sexual misconduct is really important stuff to abide by.
Sure.
And just go to work and don't do stupid stuff.
Yeah.
That's like baseline.
Yeah, sure.
Right speech. And so like eat your own noodles is one of the advices.
Yeah. Eat your own noodles is even, you know, a redirection maybe of some intelligence that's gotten too active and too, you know, it's an interesting thing in the Buddhist tradition, right? You have to ask for teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Also in like shamanic traditions, you have to ask for a reading.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, as far as I understand it, some people develop a high degree of intuition, and they can read other people. And so, my shaman friends, I said, "Well, what do you do if you're in a restaurant? You know, and you see somebody, you start to get information coming in about the person." I thought, well, okay, I understand the idea of don't go up to them, tell them stuff.
Yeah.
But they took it farther. They said, "Don't open the book.
Don't even look.
Just turn it off."
So this is also related to eat your own noodles, right? Don't go there.
Yeah, don't go there.
Yeah.
Even at the mental level.
Yep.
So now let's talk about employees.
Yeah.
Because you're a boss, right?
Yeah.
So you have to eat the other people's noodles a little bit when you're the boss, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. Things can get complicated, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm intrigued by is the overlay in the professional environment of the family dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like being a boss?
I don't like the word boss, but I like being a boss.
Okay. What word would you use? Leader?
Leader.
Okay. You like being a leader?
Yeah, I like being a leader.
Okay. And so what have you learned that you could share with everybody out there in
Well, I always think, world? What Buddhist principles do I bring to play? And the wisdom people here, they know, like I talk about Samaya,
right,
actually.
Right, oh, at
work. Well, we talk about Shila Samadhi Prajna. So Shila, we interpret as, basically, I consider businesses, the business, internal business, and working with employees and us all working together is basically what we're doing is making promises to each other.
Okay.
So the whole, you can boil the whole thing down to a group of people coming together, making promises to each other right. to get somewhere.
Right.
And so I say that, when I use Buddhist terminology of wisdom, I say we're all making our samayas together.
Mm-hmm.
They're our promises.
Commitments. Commitments.
We make our commitments. And then our shila, our discipline, our main discipline is to keep those commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And so what might that look like? Editorial's working on a manuscript. And they have to finish it by a certain date,
right?
And in a certain it has to be in a certain condition to hand over to production. So that's a promise from editorial to production.
Right.
There's one day
timeline,
and it comes down to one single day. It's a promise, a deliverable, and so that's one of the main things that wisdom between those two departments. And so then people have a shared commitment there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's two people that have a commitment right. around that date and what's going to be delivered. And so you have to honor that. That's
right.
really important. And so how should that commitment, how should that samaya, if I'm still using the Buddhist terminology, right. come about? So we have a dialogical approach. So whoever's involved in that commitment, they will get together. What can you do?
Right.
When do you need it?
Right.
They come up. It's not me saying, that has to be ready on this date
right.
as a boss.
Right.
I'm like, so let's get around a table. What are we all going to agree to and commit to hold?
Right.
And you know, Buddhist teachings and how I've worked with my teachers have really informed my management style. And then I always say that, and then we have a thing where, so that's the when. We
mm-hmm.
share the when.
Mm-hmm.
Now the how
right.
is up to the person who's responsible, who's holding the manuscript or holding
okay.
the job.
They do that how? That's their noodles.
That I don't. Yeah, that's their noodles. That's right. And everyone, you don't care how they're going to do
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they turn up on that day and honor their commitment.
So you don't micromanage at that point.
Yeah, I think that's the independence. That's the skillful means, right?
That's a great template. That's such a great model yeah. for running something.
And then we always say, you can talk about the how,
right?
But when you haven't, it's the time to talk about the how is not when you're not going to make the when.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't turn up to the day of the when
mm-hmm.
and start talking about the how.
Right.
You need to have done that months ago. And that's the sort of language we use around wisdom.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly, I wonder if that principle has been expostulated anywhere really skillfully, because that's a really good principle for business. Maybe when you get an MBA, they teach you that, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really doubt it. What about leaving business at work? Like, are you ever at home on your bed at 11 at night typing an email because somebody's up in Singapore at that time? Or is your work lacing through your everyday life in a kind of invasive way?
It's lacing through my life. I wouldn't say it's invasive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can, you know, my practice and the business sort of always operating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in this idea. We talk about energy and virya.
Yeah, virya.
They're keeping energy together, and then that may need turning off at some stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Turning off the email, turning off the
yeah.
computer.
So just what you're referring to is there's a chapter in the book called Learning
yeah.
How to Monitor Your Energy, which is kind of intriguing. As you practice meditation, even if you practice for a day,
mm.
you notice your energy lagging. They call it laxity and elation, right?
Yeah.
Those are the two obstacles to having a steady practice. So when you start to sag, you know, which is, you know, when you're doing a lot of things, you're carrying a lot of weights, you start to, like an old mule, you're just going, I don't want to hear one more person coming into my office. I don't want to hear one more complaint about the timeline.
Yeah.
You know, Do you have any sort of techniques that you use to kind of rouse your what we call wind torus?
Yep. I think psalm, the idea of psalm, so now I use another Buddhist concept is psalm. And that psalm means like border. So if you go into retreat, you create a psalm around you.
Okay.
And so I do the first weekend of every month, those 2 days are retreat days. So I do a proper psalm. I don't come out of the house. I do my practice. And then I'll do, like, I just came back from a month in Sikkim. So I think those times are really important for re-energizing.
Right. So leaving time for formal, uninterrupted formal practice with a boundary around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meaning you don't answer emails during that time?
Oh, no. The internet's turned off.
Internet's off.
That's part of the psalm, turning off the internet.
This is another book right there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another book right there.
Yeah, no, this is, and for creativity, this is amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
This space you can give yourself.
I think so many people are steadily not having any psalm.
Yeah.
And it's going away.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is there's a kind of obsessive and relentless quality of communicating, and there's no refreshment of this rejuvenation principle.
Yeah.
So, you know, somebody was asking the other day, what about, you know, are we, remembering up, we did the
Q&A, live Q&A.
Yeah. And somebody was saying, how do you, in a world that's obsessed with this kind of communication technology, how do you establish any kind of ground of sanity? I'm pretty convinced that there's going to have to be some. I think that we now have a way of talking about it, where you whatever form it's taken, even if it's a chip in your head, you turn it off.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, and you just go back into the still, you know, Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, I quote him a lot, the three pills. You know the three pills?
No.
He says this: you have to take the red pill, the white pill, and the blue pill. And the first one is stillness.
Yeah.
Second one is silence.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is spaciousness.
Yeah.
And that's what he describes meditation, which I love. I've kind of like, shamelessly quoted and imported that. Because that puts it in a very simple place for somebody who doesn't speak the, you know, the secret handshake coded language.
Yeah.
Stillness, I get that. Don't move.
Yeah.
Try not moving for a while without going to sleep.
Yeah.
Westerners, when they stop moving, they fall asleep immediately for the most part. I went to a meditation place in LA and they were like couches. People were lying down. That was their idea of like, okay, that's the only way I'm going to get out of this thing. I just got to collapse. But stillness and then silence and spaciousness. And I think if you just, those are the viruses that are coming, entering the system.
Well, we should think of those as food. Like, it's like a food.
Mm.
Stillness, silence.
Oh.
These are like a food for creativity, food for your practice. Mm. It's like eating, sleeping.
Yeah.
You need these times. That's why you need a psalm. I think you're right. I think, you know, 5 years' time, there's going to be people knocking down your door saying, David, take me to the monastery. Where I can put my phone away.
It's happening already.
Yeah.
It's interesting, in the corporate, high-end corporate world, there's a tremendous interest in going away to these places, Latin America or Asia or whatever. And, you know, maybe some interest in the Buddhist side.
Yeah.
But definitely in the transformative experiences, like going for an ayahuasca journey or something like that, sign me up.
Yeah.
But the idea that they could then take the same principles they learned of sort of steady, precise way of being and bring that over to a form of practice, I think that's going to be a slow fit because people are burnt out and they're looking for a kind of relief.
Yeah, no, I imagine, you know, the monastery at Sikkim that I go to, I imagine taking a group of CEOs there and running some sort of like some sort of program there. Yeah. I think that
and you designing the content.
Yeah, Yeah, I think the content's pretty self-evident.
Yeah, so when you talk about creating a program like that in Sikkim and allowing people to go on that as a sort of a journey for them and catering a little bit so that they don't see it as something exotic.
No.
My intuition is lately a lot of people have been not reclining in the Asian, they're actually building them up, the monasteries and things like that. And I have to think somebody with powerful mind and awareness is going, we're going to create a bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to like begin to ship people back and forth over the bridge, just like the cover of the book where the monastery and they're coming down from the monastery.
And this is the important part, coming back into the world.
Yeah. It's kind of inspiring, you know, to talk with you as it always is. All the people on my podcast are people I talk like this with anyhow.
Yeah.
So it's just been a kind of, I anticipate having a lot of fun with it. And the conversations move gracefully between, you know, spiritual practice, mm-hmm. Life, you know, everyday life, and creative ideas about business. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, fantastic that we're on this journey together, Daniel.
Oh, no, I treasure this friendship.
Yeah.
I'm glad we can work together. It's like tendril in action.
Yeah.
And I think your book is really important because it's really at the forefront of bringing these ideas in a practical way for people to, in their daily life, just like live this stuff.
Yeah.
Find freedom, find creativity, and really, you know, dissolve these, like, this duality between spirituality and, you know, daily life.
Yeah.
I think this is what the West... maybe the West's role as Buddhism comes to the West. Mm-hmm. This could be one of the main roles, this integration.
Sure. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much
for
joining the podcast, and I hope we can have you back again soon.
Of course.
Okay.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.